got chickens in the houses, and they got chickens in the trees. Chicken in the pots, the martyr of the Petaloomies. Out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay? Now Marvin got me started, sold me my first hen. Now I got 4 and 20, and 24 more again. I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay? Chicken in the morning, it's chicken in the night. Weren't for chicken Petaluma, never would have reached its height. I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful of Smart Talk about food, wine, and farming here in Sonoma County in the North Bay and beyond. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. I hope you had a great weekend. I have loved the weather this weekend. The sun breaking through, the blanket of fog, a little bit of rain, not too hot. It's just been great. And I made this fabulous discovery. I'm very late to this. I didn't know that this had been happening. It's sort of like they're selling crack at the Sebastopol Farmers Market. Joe, the greengrocer, I went to the market like I always do, and I usually take my dogs and leave them in the car, and then after I get all my purchases and put them in the car, I take the puppies, and I walk the perimeter, not in the market, because, you know, I know the rules, and you can't take your dogs, so because I know the rules, I can't break them. But so I was walking the perimeter, and on the Petaluma Avenue side, where they have tables where you can eat from Caesar's fabulous sexy lamb plate, or the paella, or the really popular Joe's Greengrocer, his BLTs, his all the different things. Well, there were these two women sitting and talking across from each other, and each one had a plate of bacon. A plate of bacon. And I just couldn't resist saying, I stopped and I leaned over and I whispered, I said, it is all I can do to stop myself from stealing your bacon. And so I walked by and Joe was right there cooking. And I said, Joe, what did those women get? And he says, oh, they come every week. They get a plate of bacon. And I said, how much? And he said, it's $1 a slice, crispy or chewy. And crispy, and handed him my dollar and walked away. Came back with another dollar and said, I need more crack, baby. And had it. And it's like, that's brilliant. That it just, I mean, yes. Somebody just out there in the open air selling a piece of bacon cooked perfectly. Made me very happy. That was my breakfast. That and two cups of pu'er tea, my breakfast. On that note, we are getting to the main topic tonight, because it is with great pleasure that I welcome John Ash. This is at least your fourth appearance.
Maybe fifth. It is. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But I love coming to the studio. Someday you should do a little tour of the studio, because on the walls here are these things from history. They're called CDs.
CDs. And there's even down the
millions of them.
Yes, we're surrounded. And, now with iPhones, you can do that panorama.
Yeah.
I will do a panorama photograph and put it up. That's a good idea. So you have, it's only been like, what, a year and a half, 2 years that you had the culinary birds?
Yeah.
Now you've got another book out, Cooking Wild. More than 150 recipes for eating close to nature.
Yeah, which was kind of an interesting thing. Part of it was a little bit of my growing up years. I grew up with, no one wants to hear this story.
Yes, we do.
With my grandparents on a ranch in Colorado.
No, we do. I want to know as much about that time of your life as possible.
And so it was just a natural thing to do, to go out and gather stuff. And the book is, a little bit about, harvesting and going out and finding things. But it also, part of it was to kind of recognize how close we are to wild food, and we sometimes don't recognize it, especially in our part of the world here in Sonoma County, with wild mushrooms. And this time of year, it's perfect this time of year because of all of those little green things that grow everywhere.
Miner's lettuce. Oh, yes, I love miner's lettuce.
Wild arugula.
Wild arugula, really wild arugula.
It really is wild
arugula. Because I know a lot of people who grow it.
Yeah.
So tell us about where you find it, how, I didn't know you could actually go out and pick arugula.
Yeah, no, it's out there. It's something that, it and a whole bunch of these.
Purslane.
Purslane is a great one, which comes a little later. But right now, of course, my favorite, which is a beautiful picture in the book of stinging nettles, that people are so afraid of. But, often when you go to farmer's markets, you'll see an intrepid gatherer.
Well, right now, there's a dearth, at least in Sebastopol. We relied on Nancy Skull's fabulous stinging nettle. And now I believe Sam is continuing on with Middleton Farm, but only at the Healdsburg Market, not in Sebastopol. So right now, so there's a couple of people who bring it now and then, but not very often.
Well, I think it's a hard sell, to people because they're a little intimidated by, I can't touch them and all of this stuff. But of course, as soon as you cook them, you put heat to them.
60 seconds.
They're delicious.
Yeah, whenever I write about them in my column, there's usually a burst in sales. But then people seem to forget. But soup, stinging nettle soup.
Yeah.
And I was up at a place, you've probably been there, and you might even remember the name. It's on Vancouver Island. It is a member of Relais Chateau.
Yeah.
What's the name of that?
Oh, it's a. I know.
You have to take a train. Yeah, I stayed there. Yeah. You have to take the train from Victoria, and then you go somewhere, and they send a car. You're out in the middle of nowhere. It's a beautiful train ride. And then Relais Chateau just has such fabulous service. Yeah. And so I was on a very small press trip, and we went there. And I believe we had both lunch and dinner the night we stayed. And they had the most extraordinary pappardelle. Nice white noodles that were Kelly green, made with a puree of stinging nettles. So good. And they're really quite easy. Really 30 seconds in water.
They're the simplest thing in the world.
How do you deal with them in the book?
I talk about a couple of different ways, making soup out of it. But my favorite way, I have to say, is to make a pesto out of it. And then pesto, of course, you can then fold into anything.
Right,
You can put it on your beloved late at night or something.
Nancy Skull always liked to make, she always said, you need to make a frittata out of it.
Yeah.
Make a frittata. And she says, and don't cook it first because you waste it. It will cook in the eggs.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
No, it's great. The other part of it was to kind of honor those things that, sometimes we don't have very much information about. Part of the thing, as you know, about doing a book is that it encourages you to dig in and find out about things that you didn't know about before.
One of the wonderful things about writing a book. It's like permission.
Yes, yeah. And to see what other experts are out there and all that stuff. So I found a lot of these wild guys, who are you know, especially in the meat section of the book, you know, bison and stuff like that, mm-hmm. which, of course, we don't see very often. I guess you can go to Costco or something and get ground bison.
And there's a couple of less huge places where you occasionally see bison around here, but not very often. Yeah. I think somebody does a bison burger now and then. I forget who that is.
I thought Ted Turner was going to conquer the bison world, but I guess he hasn't.
You know, he doesn't seem to have. And do you go into any of the wild birds?
Yes, yeah. So one of this thing is, so should I reveal this as writers, which you are certainly a wonderful writer. It's that whole idea about recycling stuff, you know, not recycling, not doing the same recipes that you've done before, but I've learned a little something about this, so now I can talk a little more knowledgeably about
it. I just did that with four recipes for avocado that I did when I wrote California Home Cooking, which came out in 1997. And I'm just a slightly different cook now, so I revisited, because avocados are fabulous this year.
Yeah.
So I revisited four recipes, but they're a little bit different now than they were 20 years ago.
Well,
and I think that's legitimate.
Well, it is, and especially, well, as you've pointed out, there are so many other varieties. I mean, we all love Haas avocados, of course, but there are so many other varieties of avocados out there, and it's so fun to go find them.
Yeah, you know, more is available in the marketplace. Yeah. So, you know, when I first saw this, Cooking Wild, I didn't think about the meat side of it. That's really interesting. Well,
the meat and the fish.
Yes.
Because probably the last bastion of wild food, really, for all of us, is the ocean.
Yes.
And unfortunately, it's going away. I've been involved with Monterey Bay Aquarium for a number of years with Seafood Watch.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of our litanies that we kind of remind people of is that wild fish, you know, they're almost gone. And so better eat them now because.
So distressing.
And but the maybe the positive side is that farming, as much as farming has been kind of knocked down by a lot of people, it's the future of fish and shellfish for
all
of us.
So. But do you, and you know, I have no problem whatsoever with farm shellfish.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
We've been eating farm shellfish for a really long time. I also feel, though, I don't think we're going to lose wild fish. I think they'll come back because I believe the earth is self-healing.
You are just this old hippie. You're just such a believer in this.
Gaia, the earth force? I think it's Gaia. I just believe that, you know, the earth is self-healing, and so are people. And I believe that something we're not expecting is going to bring us back from the brink.
In the interim, what's happening,
which is really
pretty interesting. So for the first time now, Monterey, who have been kind of the gold standard for telling us what to eat, fin fish and shellfish-wise and all of that stuff, have now, they've approved two salmon producers who are farm-raised. One does it entirely on land, so there's no pollution of the ocean and all that stuff. And the other one is one way down in Patagonia who are doing a good job, too. So I think it's the ingenuity of man, you know.
And I do have great faith. I mean, who would have thought, not that 25 years ago, who would have foreseen email? And I was relaxing in bed this morning. I made my cup of tea. Yeah. It was pretty early in the morning. It was foggy. I wanted to stay in bed with the puppies. And I had my Mac Air not plugged in to an electrical source because it was charged. And I was watching an old episode of 6 Feet Under. And I just looked at it and I thought, you know, 25 years ago, this would have been science fiction.
No, it's true.
You know, we can't have, the world has transformed in our lifetime so greatly.
So how do you feel about that? Part of my sense of it is that we're going so fast, and along the way, and especially as a food person, that we're kind of forgetting. In a way, it was the idea of this book on wild food was you know, there's all this stuff that has always been there. So mm-hmm. let's just recognize it and kind mm-hmm. of revisit it, because I think there's not a lot of revisiting that goes on. It's right. because we all want to go to the next new hot restaurant and hot chef and yeah. all
well,
this stuff.
Find it more for me. I see it as a fabulous tool. Mm-hmm. I was thinking when I wrote, say, the first edition of Oil and Vinegar, there was no internet. If I wanted to find out what stores in various parts of the world, what their focus on olive oil was, for example, I had to go to the library, get a phone book for Georgia, say, and start seeing if I could find gourmet shops. There was no way to get information about Italy unless I could find somebody who, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's become much more efficient. Much more efficient than that. I mean, I think everything is mixed, but just the fact that we've come this far is pretty astonishing, and I just think we're going to do that about the environment.
I hope so.
I hope. I mean,
I
we're going
to. It's my hope.
Yeah. I don't know why I'm so optimistic, but anyway, more about back to the book. Yes. I will quote Yammering.
Yeah, yeah.
Amaranth. Talk to me about amaranth being wild.
So this was one of the sections or chapters where grains and seeds mm-hmm. and all of that stuff. And, you know, things like amaranth and, you know, and many we know, we take for granted, like mm-hmm. pine nuts and all the stuff.
Well, I want to talk about pine nuts next.
But
in
if you
detail.
Really go back to what pine nuts were. So I have this very personal association with that, having spent some of my early years in Arizona. And so we would go up to the White Mountains of Arizona to the pinon trees mm-hmm. there and actually harvest the pine cones and then beat the nuts out of mm-hmm. them. They were so good. And they're
sweet.
So much better
so sweet.
Than those that are harvested and mm-hmm. now cultivated and mm-hmm. grown, most of which we get from China.
Do you know about pine mouth?
Yes. Yeah.
I got pine mouth. But it was before anyone was talking about it.
Yeah.
I ate a lot of pine nuts. I just craved them. And a couple days later, I noticed this very horrible bitter taste.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what was wrong. And then I was scared. I thought, my career with food is over.
Yeah.
And then people wonder if they have a brain tumor. There's these things.
Yeah.
And finally, I came across something. And it's because China is growing two varieties that have nothing to do with, that are not approved.
Yeah. Yeah.
So don't eat, you know, and the ones from, the ones that you gather.
The real ones.
The ones that I had, I don't know where I got them, but I had a taste for them when I was like 5 and 6 years old.
Yeah.
And I would sit first and pick them out of a pine cone.
Yeah.
And then I would peel them.
Yeah.
So we have that in common. And they're just, they have, like, you can't compare them. They have so much more flavor.
Yeah.
What do you like to do with them?
Well, you know, probably just eat them.
Yes,
you know, which is
no reason to grind them up into pesto.
But there are all kinds of things. One of the other ones that, and again, this was my Arizona experience that I love going deeper into, because there's an amazing guy, somebody that I know you know, Gary Nabhan, who is at University of Northern Arizona, who is an ethnobotanist, and he's written some of the great books on food of indigenous people mm-hmm. of the Americas and all of that stuff. And I've he's written a number of books which are sometimes a little more difficult than I would, but
not for the general public.
He's a great writer. And so I ran into him and I was sort of saying, you know, I remember in Arizona when I was there that people would go out, these are just not ethnics, but just regular people would go out and harvest mesquite. And I said, what did they harvest? And of course, mesquite, if you've ever been around mesquite trees, we only think about it as charcoal for grilling. But it produces, and it's a prodigious producer of seed pods, which are ground into flour and are apparently one of the most amazingly nutritious flours that you can use. And his whole thing was getting, especially the indigenous people of the mm-hmm. Americas, back to native diets and all that stuff. So
yes,
which will make them healthier and all that stuff. So that was a fun part of the book. To mm-hmm. Okay. So I actually found a producer, actually a couple of producers for mesquite flour, and made wow. all kinds of things out uh-huh. of mesquite flour.
That, which, oh, how fun. Which and is, I bet it's...
And it's gluten-free.
I was going to say, I bet it's naturally yeah, gluten-free. Yeah, yeah. That's so funny.
But it, there are those things that exist all around us that we somehow, we don't see.
Yeah, and sometimes some things we pass every day.
So I think sometimes yeah. the book was about just look, you know, just look at what's there. Take some time to sort of see what's there, see what's possible to eat. Mm-hmm. It isn't fast food.
It's unless you're walking and you just pick a leaf.
Yeah.
And then that's fast.
Yeah, yeah.
What? I don't know if this is a fair question, but maybe. What most surprised you as you were exploring? Was it, say, the mesquite flour? Was it something, or maybe several surprises?
Well, that was one of them, because there is, well, with mesquite, I don't mean to focus just on that, but there was, you know, there were a group of Indians who would run hundreds of miles, and they would make a little kind of mixture of, called pinole, which was a mixture of mesquite flour and pine nuts mm-hmm. and all of these things, and that's what they would sustain themselves with as they were running across the desert and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, wow, that's so amazing. And,
yeah.
You know, that kind of... you know, it's really botany, you know,
mm-hmm, yes.
those things that are there. It was a little bit of what I think for us all when Michael Pollan did his first book, you know, about, uh-huh. oh, my God.
We're going to take a real quick musical break here, and we will be right back with more talk with John Ash. Book is Cooking Wild, More Than 150 Recipes for Eating Close to Nature by our very own treasure, John Ash. So great to have you here in the studio, John.
Thanks.
And I'm just like filled with questions. Talk to me about trout. And first of all, how to get the best. You know, there is nothing like a trout fresh out of a lake.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a good question. So trout is a sustainable fish. It's farmed, but it's mm-hmm. farmed sustainably. And interestingly, something like 90% of the trout that we get in the market come from Idaho, because they have these beautiful clear water mm-hmm. places that they grow them in, and they do a really very good job of them. So this is the personal part of it. So growing up with my grandparents, mm-hmm. we had these little streams, and what I would do is to catch trout, we didn't fish for them with a fishing pole. We actually would go swimming for them, and under the banks where the rivers came in and dug out the mm-hmm. bank, big trout would hide back there. They would just kind of...
I've seen films of that.
Go to sleep and mm-hmm. do all of that kind of stuff. So we would dive down, get them just very gently. So this is something you can do next weekend if you want to. very gently touch them, rub them, and then just at the precise moments, sometimes you would miss them. You'd take and put your hand, your fingers into their gills and pull them out of there.
So they like to be petted.
And sometimes we would get these 2-3 pound rainbow trout that were the most fabulous things in the world. And then we'd either eat them there, make a little campfire and eat them there. Mm-hmm. Or my grandmother's favorite way, which I included in the book, was to wrap them in bacon and saute them. And it's like, whoa, they were so delicious. But the trout that we find in the market, so this is one of those messages, they're all from sustainable sources.
Really? So farm trout is okay?
Farm trout is perfectly fine, yeah.
Huh. They're what do they feed? Do you know anything? What do they feed them?
Well, they feed them, up in Idaho, they feed them a lot of natural things. I don't know the mix of that stuff.
But if they're approved by...
It's not
beef
pellets or something.
Yeah, or
like
beef
that.
Tallow.
Yeah, or beef or,
so, and I would assume,
or soy.
So I would assume that's the same thing with the salmon that Monterey Bay Aquarium has approved, because that's been one of the huge problems were fed.
What they were fed. And also the other big issue with, especially with farm-raised salmon, was the use of antibiotics.
Biotics, right.
Because they, they grew them in big pens.
Right.
If one got sick, the whole bunch got sick.
I saw inland salmon farm in northern Minnesota a long time ago. Yeah. It was horrifying.
Well, that was my first introduction. So this was early on in my restaurant career. Mm-hmm. I was buying Norwegian salmon, and I had this, because they sold me a bill of goods, that here they are, the salmon grown in the icy fjords of Norway and all that stuff. And so I had a chance to go to Norway to visit some of these salmon farms, and then actually saw how they were growing them, and it was like, oh, no, I can't eat these, because they were... What they were doing was many of the salmon didn't make it to adulthood, so they would take them and grind them up. It's a little bit like what happens with conventional chicken farming and things like that. And it's like, no, we don't want to do that.
Yeah, I've seen some of it. Yeah. It's really no creature should live the lives that they have to live. Yeah. So trout, you can just. Your best fish market, you go to your center as a seafood or something and get yourself some trout?
But we don't see it a lot here.
No.
For God knows what reason, because it's, as I say, a sustainable fish. It's delicious. It's a blank canvas. You can do a million things with it to make it taste delicious. You can grill it. You can do all of that kind of stuff.
You can pack it in salt.
Yes, absolutely,
slice lemon over it and cover it with salt.
I know we've talked about this in the past. Unfortunately, Americans, we're just so stuck on, we only eat three fish. We eat salmon, we eat halibut, and sometimes we eat swordfish. We don't eat anything else, So I think we're a little different here in Northern California,
most
parts. But look at restaurant menus. Look at what they're offering. Yeah.
And the fact, like sand dabs. Sand dabs are one of the most wonderful substitute if you don't have trout. Yeah. I mean, I love sand dabs. Yeah.
See, but you're a forager, so you'll go to the coast and you meet fishermen, and that's the great joy of where we live.
Some of the best, probably the single best piece of fish I've ever had was from Lake Huron, when Diamond Crystal Kosher Salt, bless their hearts, flew me to Detroit and then took me up to St. Clair, where the salt is produced. I just really wanted to see it, and they took me out to lunch. Right next door to the main facility, we had lake perch, fried lake perch.
Yeah, yeah.
I swear they just coaxed them out of the water to jump through the fryer onto your plate. They were so delicious, and we never see perch out here. Never.
No, we don't. But in the Midwest, it's kind of like, and I included it in the book. In the Southeast, I include not white perch, but walleye, which is one that I love a lot. Uh-huh. And the other one in the Southeast is mullet. If you live in Florida or Georgia or someplace like that, it's the best game fish, and it's something that's caught. And if that weren't enough, there is in Florida this most amazing producer of Botarga, which are the eggs of the fish that are dried in a very ancient way. And then you take
that. I don't know if I've ever had it. I know of it, but I don't think I've tasted it.
Oh, you
got
to get it. So you have to.
Have to go to Florida?
No, you can order it.
Okay.
Online, you know. And you can get it from Italy and also. But what is this dried and smoked mullet roe? Mm-hmm. And you take it and you shave it, and it's the most delicious thing on pasta. You know, so it's the most extraordinary thing in the world. And it's been around for centuries, of course, around the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. But
good. Okay, there's something on my list to try.
Botarga.
Botarga. What about sea vegetables? Seaweed, all of that.
They're great. And, you know, I could have written a whole book on, actually, somebody should write a book.
Somebody should, yes.
On sea vegetables. The couple that I included in here, one that I really love, which we can get, are sea beans, which can be harvested.
Sea beans, they're
locally.
So good.
You need to do
you need a license. You have to get a license.
You need to kind of know what you're doing. You can't just go out and whack them to death. But they're pretty available. And they're crunchy and delicious.
They almost look like little teeny tiny asparagus, each little stalk.
Yeah, and have a similar kind of flavor to them.
And there have been a couple people that sort of come and go at our farmers markets offering wakame and nori and all different kinds. And the nori from the coast is so different from what you get in an Asian market because it's been ground up and then smeared and dried.
Yeah. It doesn't have nearly the same flavor. No, we have, for anyone who wants to, up in Mendocino County, a couple of producers of sea vegetables of all kinds, which are really pretty delicious.
Yeah. And, you know, I have a friend who's Kashaya Pomo, and she brought the elders here. This was several years ago, onto Mouthful. And they had flatbread, Native American flatbread, sort of like a tortilla, but not. And she had sauteed or fried, was it wakame? I'm not sure if it was wakame. It might have been. But she just fried up.
Yeah.
She had fried it up, wrapped it in dry flatbread. It was nothing else. It was so delicious.
So can I give you a hot idea?
Yeah.
So here you go. So this was something I did during my hippy dippy days. Instead of making a BLT, you know, which is bacon, lettuce, and tomato, I made the DLT, which is, and unfortunately we don't get it on our coast, but you get it from the East Coast, is dulse.
Oh, dulse, yes.
And dulse fried, which fries in about 4 seconds. And put that on with tomatoes and lettuce. It is the most. I'm saying this to you as the queen of
I'm BLT. Having my first BLT of the season tonight for dinner because my guest last week, Ian from, Handlebar Farm, he wouldn't tell us the variety of tomato. But he harvested his first tomatoes last week.
Wow.
And these are like grown in the ground, not hydroponic. And I had to go to the market early. Last week he sold out before the market opened.
Yeah.
So I bought bacon and I have tomatoes and I have Raymond's bakery bread. So I'm having a BLT for dinner tonight.
Well, if you.
Dulce.
I mean, if you want to.
I like every version.
Eschew the bacon, the meat part of it. Try it with dulce. It's pretty good.
It's not that I would eschew the bacon. It was just, I would just vary it.
Yes, that's right. Exactly.
Because I did a ZLT. Another one is salmon skin. If you've scaled the salmon, you fry that salmon skin up crisp.
Yeah.
Makes a great.
It's the best thing at sushi restaurants, don't you think?
Oh, God. Yes, I love
skin
it.
Roll.
But it makes makes a fabulous BLT without the bacon.
Yeah. You can fry anything.
Yes.
So one of the ones, there was a young man, and I know you know him, and his name went out of my mind, who did chicken skin.
Yes.
And, you know, crispy fried
chicken skin.
Is like, whoa.
Well, yeah. I've been eating that since I was.
Yeah.
Crispy chicken skin and crispy turkey skin.
Yeah.
Can I tell one short story?
Sure.
My best memory of Thanksgiving was this one. My daughter Gina had just been born. My husband was overseas, Vietnam War. I was at my mother's. Much older half-sister was there. The turkey had come out of the oven. And I went to just pull off a little piece, and it came off. and I just like a huge, like the whole top of the crispy turkey skin. And we both stared at it for a minute, and my sister started to grab it. And I went running as fast as I could and slammed the bathroom door before she got there, locked it, and ate the whole thing. It was so good.
better than any other part of the turkey.
it's the best. Yeah. It is absolutely the best. We're going to take one more musical break here on Mouthful, and we'll be right back. That was the Handsome Family, So Much Wine. And that made me think back to, you know, John, gosh, you were the chef at Fetzer for a long time at that fabulous culinary center there.
Yeah.
You're doing you're still teaching over at the CIA.
I teach at the CIA occasionally, mostly on the wine side.
Right, that's what I thought, yes.
Which is interesting. And I get to teach kind of all around the world,
right,
you know, which is great. Mostly at places that I've taught at before, but locally at Ramekins and at Relish. And we do upcoming in a month, or our annual, actually we're doing two this year, Dry Creek Peach.
Right. I was just thinking about
dinners in the
orchard
thing, which are really fun.
Really?
I think we tried to get you to come a couple of times, and I don't know why.
Maybe this year.
Okay, you should come.
Maybe this year.
Because it's totally cool. It's also great people watching. I shouldn't gossip like this.
Oh, please do.
but we get all these people who, you know, spend a lot of money to come to this thing. We always have great wine, and it's kind of a cooking class, but not really, because there's not much you can do in front of people.
Well, now that go ahead.
But you get these beautiful women. I mean, really gorgeous women, which, of course, makes it very fun. But they insist on wearing high-heel shoes.
Of course they do. Of course they do.
Out in the orchard. You know, and it's like, no, don't do that.
There's always more beautiful women at those things than there are gorgeous men. When are we going to get, like, invited? Idris Elba or somebody to come to one of those, and I will be there in a hot minute.
Well, come this year.
I will try.
There's one in July and one in August. Which great.
Well, the other thing, too, you know, I'm going to be launching my big new web project.
Yeah.
And so I will be able.
So tell people about this.
I have been.
Have you? Oh, good.
Oh, definitely. Okay. And I will be doing a big push. We're going to do a quiet launch on June 3rd just to make sure that the technical stuff behind it is working properly, and then there'll be a big push. But one of the things that I will be able to do without having a gatekeeper, you know, editor, publisher, that sort of thing, I will be able to, number one, photograph things like this, talk about them as I want to talk about them, but I'll also be able to feature things like this in a feature that will be on the website called Today in Sonoma. And I will be posting every day, a minimum of one thing. But sometimes one of those things will be, now is the time to buy your ticket for this very special event. So I can do as far out as we need to take that to an untapped market.
Yeah.
So I will definitely, I'm putting big stars next to Dry Creek Peach Dinners.
Yeah.
And,
you
know, they've actually ruined me. I find it very hard to eat anyone else's peaches.
I know, isn't it true? And their first peaches are in the market right now.
Yes.
I couldn't believe it, you know, because it's so early.
Early. And that
global
means
global warming.
And Arctic Gem, that's my peach.
Yeah.
And Gail is so great. She shows up at my back door with a flat of Arctic.
Isn't she the sweetest person?
She's such a wonderful person. So Arctic Gems, we may have them by the middle or even early July this year, because everything is so speeded up.
Yeah.
And their farm stand's probably going to open soon, too.
I think they even open this weekend something.
I will give her a call.
Yeah.
So we've got one in July and one in August.
Yeah.
And you've got classes that you're teaching. Over at the CIA, those classes are in part for consumers, right? They're
entirely for consumers. So what I teach, the one that I teach regularly, which I teach every month over there, is the marriage of food and wine, you know, which is something I'd love to talk about. And it's very fun because it both hopefully helps people understand how we taste, and then we get to try it with things. And then the whole idea of it is, I lead them through a tasting of this, but it's a very subjective thing. You know, what you like in wine and what I like in wine and food can be very different. But it's to teach them that they can adjust things.
You're reading my mind.
To make them work. I mean, it's that old Julia Child idea that, you know, just put a little bit of this in and now it tastes better with that wine that you're going to drink it with.
Yeah. So I just read something. I don't know. Can't remember the source, but I thought of you and I thought of me because we've had this discussion many times about acidity.
Yeah.
It says you want to enjoy a white wine, a dry white wine with your steak, squeeze a little lemon over it.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, this sounds like something John would say.
Well,
what do you think about that?
Well, I absolutely agree with it. And it wasn't my idea. So it was really Julia's idea.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, if there's one thing that you can do to make food and wine go together, I mean, if you're not going to do anything else, it is to make sure that the acidity in the food is in balance with the acidity in the wine, which almost always means you need to add some acidity to the food, which could be citrus, it could be the wine, it could be verjus, it could be you know, anything to kind of put it, and almost entirely, one of the stories I love telling is with Julia, how she would, yak at people about putting food and wine together. And in the early days, I mean, this is for those of a certain age who remember her early television shows, black and white, grainy, even before PBS, you know, that she did the...
They're called... In Boston, right?
In Boston, in her home, in her home kitchen. They were there. And people would ask her, Julia, why are you drinking wine while you're cooking that food? And she would, of course, say in that wonderful asthmatic voice of hers, well, it's because I enjoy drinking wine. But then she would often add to that that the wine that she was sipping on was the wine that she was going to serve with the food. Mm-hmm. And she would remind people that she can't change the wine. It's already in the bottle, but I can change the food to make it work better mm-hmm. with the wine.
And that's so important.
Yeah.
That's such an important thing for people to understand. What do you think about balsamic vinegar and how it impacts...
Enough already.
Yeah, thank you. And the way it impacts wine. I don't think it has it. I don't think it impacts wine in a good way. It doesn't have enough acid. It's too sweet.
No, that's an interesting point because it's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
And so it adds that kind of sweetness, which with wine, which for the most part we cherish because of its acidity, tends to kind of... I don't know, mush it out and all of this. It's not quite so good. I think it depends on the quality of the balsamic.
Of course. I mean, the true balsamic, the true Aceto Balsamico Tradizionale, that's another story entirely.
Probably not going to get that at Trader Joe's.
No. And you're not going to, and even if you do get it, you're not going to pour it on things. And that's the thing that I've found troublesome. I don't go out to restaurants very much anymore at all.
Are you a snob?
I like my own cooking.
Yeah.
I love my own cooking, and I don't have a lot of money, but I just really like my own cooking, and you know, I love that, and I have my grandson that I feed every night.
Yeah.
But I do notice on so many restaurant menus, I say, oh, this sounds great, until it gets to and finished with balsamic reduction.
Yeah.
And it's like, enough already, because it's...
So maybe there should be a new feature on your show, the enough already ingredient.
That is a great idea.
For this year. So let's vote for balsamic vinegar. Enough already. I mean, it's good, but it doesn't need to be everything.
Can I steal this?
Yeah, of course.
And I'm sure that we can both come up with a number of enough already candidates.
Yeah.
That's really great.
So maybe kale could be on that list.
You know, poor kale.
Yeah. No, it's delicious.
It is. There's so many good things to do with it. But enough already. And, you know, enough already gluten-free,
too.
That's
a new book for you. The enough already book.
But then blank pages. Here's a book. No balsamic vinegar recipes. Yeah. No kale recipes. We haven't talked much about wild duck and geese. I just turned to the page. Talk about that.
Well,
I've never had wild goose.
Oh, well, it's quite an adventure.
To my knowledge, I haven't.
Yeah, it's quite an adventure. So again, part of this was kind of growing up on a ranch in which we went hunting a lot. So we went after birds, not so much goose, but we got a lot of duck and quail and birds of that kind. And one of the books, my very first book, was a book called American Game Cooking.
I know exactly where it is on my shelf.
Which was a book that really kind of dealt with the history and the traditions of game cooking in America. And one of the interesting things was up until about the 1900s, the primary protein meat in America was not from something you bought in the store, but was stuff that was hunted, you know. So it was venison or it was birds or it was whatever it was.
Rabbit was very common.
We had a great tradition for cooking those animals and dealing with them, and then we kind of lost it all for whatever reason. And then they became very expensive. Like buying a goose, it takes your breath away, to buy a goose. But having said that, it's one of the most delicious birds in the world. Fatty, so you need to render the fat, get it out of it. But boy, the meat is just...
It's really rich.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rich, concentrated.
I think goose and duck, if somebody said to me, you can only eat two meat proteins for the rest of your life, I think it would be goose and duck.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. I'm not sure what I would do. Lamb for sure.
Yeah,
and I have to figure out the other one.
Yeah.
Good lamb.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Salmon Creek Ranch raised a few geese for Christmas last year. Because we had, you know, Sylvia Mavawala. She's not doing goose anymore. She hasn't done goose for a number of years. So there hasn't been really much local goose at all. And then Salmon Creek Ranch did a little bit. Is there anyone else?
You know, not that you can get them. There is, you can get them online. From producers, and most of them come from the Midwest, of all places, to get them. They're a little tricky to cook just because they have such a prodigious amount of fat with them that you have to deal with that fat. Mm-hmm. But that's one of the joys, the little treasures that you get is goose fat that you then use
goose
for everything.
Fat. Yes.
Goose fat and duck fat are the two things to cook everything in. Yeah. You know,
and they're very interesting animals to watch. People have used them like you might use a guard dog.
Yeah.
They've used guard geese, and they...
Yeah.
I mean, they will take care.
Oh, they will.
Really will. Yeah. Are you doing any events connected with the book? Book signings?
I am. I'm doing, actually, and I should be better prepared, but doing an event at Ramekins, in which we'll feature the book, and then doing a couple of others in the Bay Area that we'll be doing. So they can go to my website.
That's right. I've looked at your website. Nice picture of you.
ChefJohnAsh.com.
Yes. Book Passage should do something with
you. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, they're doing dinners now with Spinster Sisters.
Yeah, it's really fun.
I did one. I forget. I think just for the Good Cooks books. And then coming up in a couple of weeks, maybe early June, Joyce Goldstein.
She will be here with her new book.
Yes, with luck, we will have her here on the show.
Yeah.
We'll probably pre-record that same day.
Yeah.
Well,
it's a great thing. Every book that I've ever published, I've done a dinner, but they've always been down in San Rafael.
Right.
But usually at Left Bank or someplace like that.
Yeah, I did one there.
So I hope they invite me to do something.
I hope they do too.
Yeah.
Now, going back to your first book, if I remember correctly, there was a restaurant in the World Trade Center, and you did a cooking demonstration and book signing there. I was there.
Well,
I don't know if you remember. It was not on an upper floor. It was on a lower floor. And was it? It's not Larry.
It wasn't Windows on the World. But
no, it wasn't Windows on the World.
Yeah.
It almost seems like it was called An American Place.
It was.
Okay.
That was Larry Forgione.
It was Larry Forgione. Yes, we were there. Yeah. And then we also went to dinner. There must have been 10 or 12 of us at a place called possibly, started with an M, Elizabeth Cardiff, hosted the dinner.
I can't remember.
And Sid Goldstein?
Yeah.
Sid was there?
Yeah.
And we had the dinner was it was an Italian restaurant. I think it was pricey, and it was not as good as it should have been.
It's New York.
It was not as good as it should have been.
So just as a little comment. So Larry Forgione, you know, who's one of America's great chefs.
Absolutely.
I don't think he gets quite the recognition
that's
that he
because
should.
He doesn't have a big huge ego.
No, but he is doing now at the CIA.
Yes.
They call it the conservatory. So on weekends Larry takes students from the CIA in New York, and they put together these amazing meals there. So if you want to still eat some of Larry's great food,
great man, and such a kind man.
Yes.
Oh, look, there's a picture of sea beans.
Yeah.
They do. They look like little asparagus.
So we don't see them here so much, but go up to Seattle or Portland, and, you know, every farmer's market has sea beans.
You know who was cooking with them was out on the coast. It's now Terrapin Creek Seaweed Cafe.
Oh, right.
Cafe. She had...
Yeah. Well, probably harvested them.
Yeah,
wild
she probably
out there.
Did. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is really congratulations on this.
Thanks.
Ooh, scrambled eggs with ramps. Where do we get ramps? Do we ever get ramps around here? Ramps is sort of a wild onion from the East Coast, right?
It is, and we see it more in the Midwest and the East Coast, but they're here, and so we have our local produce suppliers.
That's right.
Bring it in. So Sonoma Organics brings them in, and all of that stuff. But it's a very short season. It's about 4 weeks.
Sneeze and it's
like
over.
That. Yeah. Yeah.
And let's see, who published? We have Running Press.
Running Press, yeah.
And the cover price is 35? Is that right?
Yeah.
$35. I can read.
It's a bargain.
It is. It's a, really, it's a very beautiful book. It's very user-friendly. Here is uni dressing for a cold vegetable salad. Yeah. There are four ingredients.
Yeah.
You know, this is not a super complicated, overly, you know, you don't have to have a kitchen crew.
No.
That's one of the things I really love about your books. You're a professional chef, but you really consider
the cook. Well, I learned. Also, the first book that I did, I think, was a little chefy, you know, and then I learned that nobody's going to do that if it takes seven fresh herbs and things like that.
Yes.
You know, make it easy.
Make it easier for the home cook. Yeah. Well, John, thank you so much for taking
time.
I really appreciate
it.
And again, the title, Cooking Wild, more than 150 recipes for eating close to nature. You can listen to John Ash on the fabulous The Good Food Hour with his co-host, Steve Garner, on KGO every Saturday from 11 to 12.
KSRO. We don't want to.
What did I say? Oh, KSRO. Yes. That was a burp. Yeah. I'm sorry. KSRO. Meet me back here next week for another yummy episode of Mouthful, Smart Talk about food, wine, and farming.